Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Welcome to the book club of the Lotus Eaters. We're having our first book club where we're joined by the author, Andy Ngo, who's written Unmasked, which is a, I would say sort of a more journalistic piece of what Antifa is and what they've done in the United States, with some obviously personal testimony from the fact that you've been interacting with these guys for years now, and you've had to deal with the worst parts of them. And with the last year's events, it's been particularly grim. But I guess we should get right into it.
So thanks for having me on again.
It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
I hope you've been well. So the first thing I wanted to mention here was on the intro that jumped out to me was talking about the fact that Antifa is kind of old news for a lot of people. Like you mentioned here that of your mentors, that Antifa is an old story. They're irrelevant. Move on. And this jumped out to me because it very much reminds me of the Italian fascist movement. I don't know how much you know about how the fascists took over in Italy, but there's a famous phrase they used to use called "Me ne frego," means "I don't give a damn." So what would happen is they'd go out and they'd commit violence, they'd beat people up, and then maybe they'd murder someone. And every single time it would be "Me ne frego," I don't give a damn. You know, when people would be horrified. So they'd start killing socialists, and then they'd start killing politicians, and it just ramped up and ramped up and ramped up. And eventually people just got bored of it. It was like, violence is just part of life in Italy. And I see similarities with that and what's happening in Portland. Like, we've gotten to the point now where they're throwing Molotov cocktails and IEDs at the police, and the response is still, I don't give a damn. Like, it's Antifa, what do you expect? So I fully agree with you when your response to this was, no, this has to be covered. These people are nuts. And they will go further than you're thinking. Anyway.
Yeah, well, in response to that, you were quoting from some of my editors and mentors in journalism. And their view was, what more, this is like back in 2019, their view was, what more is there to write about Antifa? They go out on the streets, they fight, they brawl. It's the same story every time, move on to something else. And I understood where they were coming from. And they also were warning me that I was increasingly becoming a target. This was before I was beaten in the summer of 2019. But for me, the narrative that was still in the minds of most people was that Antifa are simply anti-fascist. And I was like, I can't stop writing about them and focusing on them and recording them, photographing them until the record is set straight. And unfortunately, that did end up leading to them assaulting me on multiple occasions and escalating death threats over the many, many months since, to the point where I've had to leave my home. But I can talk about that later.
So you weren't even coming at it as a sense of these guys are clearly extremists that are going to go to the logical extremes. You were more focused on the point that people don't understand them and you wanted to explain them. You hadn't even foresaw the events of last summer, for example.
It was both. I already knew they were, by 2019, I knew they were violent extremists. And I was already familiar enough with their literature to know that the way they were being presented by local journalists and then the national press and then the international press was completely wrong. These militants call themselves anti-fascist, but as I write in the book, they espouse an ideology of anarchist communism that is extreme and calls for terroristic acts against citizens as well as the state, and that's what they do. So when their ideology is carried out to their logical conclusions, we shouldn't be surprised that they actually do launch attacks.
They genuinely believe what they're saying.
That's right. So they kill and get killed in the process. And so I hope that this book can lay to rest this claim, this false claim that's often repeated in headlines that Antifa has killed nobody and therefore they're not a threat. We shouldn't be concerned.
Or it's just people who are concerned about the rise of the far right or something like this. It's
correct.
Absolutely false. And that's one of the things. So in response to, I think, you accurately laying out what their position is. So I don't even think in most of this book you're being particularly partisan in the sense of saying these guys are bad. You're just laying out, this is what they genuinely believe, and this is what they genuinely want to happen, and this is the means by which they will do it. You know, violence, terrorism, whatever it takes, really. And in response to you laying this out, we've seen what happened with Powell bookstores. So we saw the fact that we had people down there protesting that they were even going to sell this book, that this book must be banned. I think, how many days have they been down there now? Are they still going?
They called it off after 6 days, and two of those days...
A week of protests for this bookstore.
Yes, in two of those days, the bookstore had to shut down for safety concerns. So it wasn't just people protesting saying, we don't like this book. That's fine. That wasn't their complaint.
It should be that they shouldn't sell it.
They shouldn't sell it anywhere. So the bookstore had already relented. And this is Portland's largest bookstore, and there are multiple locations. It's a very important institution, I would say, to Portland. But they weren't just happy that the store said that it would ban physical sales on its shelves. The Antifa wanted it removed completely from online, and they went out with these banners and signs that were repeating lies about me, saying that I was inciting violence against them, that this book, even though none of them had read it, would put them at risk. What it came down to is some of them had a personal vendetta because they were arrested and charged some of these riots throughout 2020, and I publicized that public information. And they claim that that is a doxing of them. But as you and I know, that's not what doxing is. Doxing is where you release actually personal information, which is what they do to me. They write my address on walls and write "kill Andy Ngo, murder Andy Ngo" around the city.
And if you had written that about them in here, it would be, I presume, criminal in the United States, even, because you would be putting their lives.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been published.
I want to labor that point a little bit more, that you said that they haven't even read it. That I thought was the most amazing part. The book is not currently released at the time of recording. It certainly wasn't released when they started protesting. None of them had any idea what was inside, and yet they knew that this named them, it named where they live, and it needs to be destroyed, and it must be burnt because it's fascist propaganda. And it was like, okay, these people are not honest actors. I don't think there was any clearer way of showing them for what they are than that instance. Even with all the violence and all the rest of it, they can mask that up in the sense of social justice, but with trying to burn a book they have not read, what defense of this is there, except that this is a propagandizing group that doesn't like being criticized? So there was also the union of the bookstore has responded, saying that they find everything you do abominable, they object to everything you do, and they find your work sickening because you've harmed their community. And I find that quote particularly interesting because it makes me wonder the kind of people who are actually running that union, you know, harming their community.
That's a good insight.
And whose community are they talking about?
Right. So I looked into people who are part of that union, which includes staff, employees at Powell's Book. Surprise, surprise, at least one of them had been arrested and charged at one of these riots before. And so, you know, for them, they should have disclosed that some of their members, at least one that I can positively identify, was, at least according to police, involved in these violent protests. So, but they didn't disclose that. Instead, they just smeared me and defamed me with these false accusations.
When they say, you know, you're sickening because you're harming their community, you're harming Antifa by saying this is what they've done and this is what they believe, which again, just I think is, even through all of the troubles we've had for the last few years, this is the best example of how to expose such folks, you know, if we were to pick an action they've done that's wrong. And I wanted to get into this. So you said that your mentors failed to see at the time that Antifa was implementing a sophisticated strategy to destabilize society using propaganda, radicalization, violence, and even electoral politics. It was wrong to reduce Antifa to a ragtag group of street hooligans. Now, there's part that I don't think gets through to even people who are familiar with Antifa. Mm-hmm. And I will admit, I had to rearrange some of my own thoughts about the group after reading this and how sophisticated they are in their thinking. Because I always sort of blew them off, particularly in the UK, because they're less violent, as sort of morons who go out and riot and think that they're going to overthrow the country. And isn't that silly? And no, they actually do have a long-term strategy here. Smashing up windows in a Starbucks is not just a meaningless action to them. How much did you ever find that people understood this point? And do you think people are now going to understand it?
Generally, the public doesn't understand it. And in fact, there are sympathizers to Antifa in the mainstream left, commentators, people who speak and write in America's papers, Record, who have mainstreamed certain tenets of Antifa's philosophy and ideology, predominantly in that the looting and breaking of windows, destruction of property, that's not violence because it doesn't, it's not against the physical body of somebody. And that right now the crisis of Black lives being murdered is so important that they're not going to shed any tears over a broken window. But I mean, in that, there's a certain number of people on the left who
I find that kind of argument compelling.
Correct, unfortunately. But like, if you look at some of these protests that have turned into riots where neighborhoods were burnt to the ground, particularly in Minneapolis, the act of shattering windows, and if you look at their literature and their propaganda that they put out, it's not just like symbolic in that it's an act against capitalism in their eyes. It also sets off a chain reaction as well. So let's say, so we can look to Minneapolis when there were days of rioting, deadly riots in 2020. These people who were dressed in black breaking windows of businesses, which then immediately led to them being looted. And then once the looters were done, these people would return with their incendiary devices like Molotov cocktails and just throw it in, and the building would be torched to the ground. And that just kept the momentum going, and all the footage and photos and videos of that then inspired Antifa and other parts of the country to organize their own solidarity direct actions. And that's what they did. So riots broke out in dozens of other cities. Portland eventually overtook Minneapolis, and that it was maintained for months and months and months, more than 120 days of daily riots. So to put into perspective for the international audience here, like, a lot of people recoiled in horror when they saw what happened on the 6th of January this year at the Capitol Hill siege slash riot. So all those actions and worse were repeated on a nightly basis in my home city of Portland, also against federal property. And the response from the people who have been loudest in condemning and calling for severe prosecutions of suspects involved in that Capitol Hill riot, they were silent last year at best, and at worst, they were encouraging of it and actually encouraging people to donate to some of these crowdfunding campaigns to get accused rioters back out on the streets.
I mean, Kamala Harris is obviously the best example. She retweeted the Minnesota Freedom Fund.
That's correct.
So it was for people who had been arrested because they committed a criminal activity to pay their bail. So this is the now Democratic vice president supporting that these people should be getting out.
And not just her, but people who worked on Biden's presidential campaign
staff. A lot of different groups, yeah. And I don't want to spoil it, but some of their financial practices that you go into is astounding. I just wanted to start off by mentioning, so for people who maybe don't know what Antifa are, I assume most people do, but just in case someone doesn't, I wanted to talk about the fact that the CHAZ for a minute, because I understood that the CHAZ was set up, so the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, where people had declared basically
in Seattle.
Yeah, in Seattle, some kind of independent state, and the police were not going to intervene. And I was just thinking, how did this actually start? And your documentation of it is scary to read, to be honest. So the fact that they were days of riots in which people went out were extremely violent. They had set fire to cop cars and stolen the AR-15s out of the cop cars. There was one brave hero who went back and stole them and disarmed them in a couple of cases, but I imagine some of those AR-15s were kept. There was also the response from the local authorities, which is, in response to these violent attacks, we should ban the use of CS gas, meaning the police couldn't really disperse crowds in a efficient manner. And then the fact that you mentioned there were rocks, IEDs thrown, police ended up with broken bones, eye injuries, burns, and then the decision was made to abandon the precinct, that we couldn't hold on to this. We give up. The police ran away. And just imagine if you lived in that area where you've just seen all this rioting taking place, and you think, okay, well, the police will put it down. They just left. They just openly left and left the area to become what it was. I can't imagine how scary that must be to live through as a person living there. And we saw the results, which was quite a lot of people being murdered for no reason, a lot of people dying for needless reasons. And there was obviously the point that anyone could see where this was going, and Antifa were not prone to try and calming down the situation at all. In fact, you mentioned the Seattle anti-fascists tweet out that we need more people with guns at CHAZ. They wanted armed people to come to this area so they could continue their revolution.
Yeah, let me just pause you there for a sec. To to really explain like how surreal what was happening in Seattle. So Seattle is the largest city in the Pacific Northwest, one of the largest cities in the United States. And there, nearby downtown, BLM Antifa extremists sieged and claimed six city blocks of property and claimed it to be a sovereign city-state not under the jurisdiction of American law. And they actually established a hard physical border that had checkpoints that was manned by armed security, people who were openly carrying pistols and rifles and were keeping an eye on who was going in and out. And this wasn't like in the middle of nowhere. This was a really densely area where there were businesses, high rises, lots of flats and apartments. So families lived there.
Lots of people who did not consent to this happening. It's just been forced upon them.
Yes, and they were forced into silence. I know they were terrified because when they were speaking to the media, and they all spoke anonymously because they were terrified of retribution, they were talking about they were hearing screams at night, shootings. That's what I heard when I was there. I spent a week there. I write about that in the book. And so it truly was, you know, you don't even have to, like, for much of Antifa's history in the U.S., it's been people who have been trying to implement a certain theory, ideology, and 2020 gave us a look into, well, their theory put into practice, actual so-called state building. And the truth of the matter is they can't build anything. They're shite at it.
I mean, it was almost worse than pure anarchy, in my view, looking at what happened.
It was just destruction. That's what they excel at, and that's what makes them really dangerous, actually. So, yes, the Chaz was allowed to go on for more than 3 weeks with the city council's blessing and the blessing of the mayor as well. She infamously called it a summer of love and described it as a collective pouring of our grief, referring to what happened to George Floyd. And so people died in Chaz. There was an attempted rape, mass destruction of property, vandalism everywhere. And the messages, it wasn't just people graffitiing. Like, if you looked at the messages, they were calling for people to kill police, like, every inch of the six-block zone. And
well, I wanted to stop you off here because you mentioned here that you'd spoken to people before you went out and did your on-the-ground reporting about it. Was, well, what happens if someone needs emergency services? And the response was that the victim of said crime would have to leave the Chaz and then get help. They could not get help inside.
Correct.
Because the emergency services just denied the idea they would go in there. It was too dangerous.
Yeah. So it was police who would not go in. But so in some of these instances where there were shootings, the homicides that happened, when police came up to try to secure the evidence scene, they were getting attacked by these people. And so many of these shootings, as far as I know, there's only been one suspect apprehended, and there were six shootings, by the way. And it's because immediately the Antifa there and their volunteer security, they would tell each other to pocket the bullet rounds on the ground, to move the evidence around, to make it so that
it was as difficult as possible to find justice.
Correct.
Yeah. Because the justice would be against their comrades in arms. So, but I wanted to mention that just to lay out that I think that's probably the most extreme thing they've done in a single instance. But of course, then you have Portland, which just went on and on and on. Like, this has been slowly growing for at least a few years in its, amount of violence. And you mentioned that part of the city resembled a failing state that day, a day of riots, with mass thugs patrolling the streets openly and freely with weapons. The authorities were unable to secure order and protect citizens per commands and limit the police engagement of protesters. So this is a day of extreme violence. And I wanted to ask, when you have a situation like that in Seattle and a situation like this in Portland, that are sort of still ongoing, the Chaz has been shut down, but the violence hasn't, as we saw on Inauguration Day. What's taking place there? Is that police incompetence, as in they're not willing to do their job or not able? Or is this the fact that it's local authorities siding with these groups, if not, you know, underestimating them and thinking they're some kind of ally?
So, police departments in the United States, if they do not have the political support of the elected officials, it really affects how effective they're able to be. And city councils and mayors and governors, for that matter, can make police feckless, for example, by passing all these new laws that would ban certain crowd control tactics, as they did in Seattle and Portland. but also the political climate was that the mayor and city councils, they all had everything to gain by condemning law enforcement and praising protesters, and everything to gain, nothing to lose by doing that. So that's what they did. So with the beat cops, I have a lot of sympathy for them. They're following a chain of command, and police captains and chiefs, they're police officers, but they're also primarily politicians. Their role is to be the face of the police department, to be in front of the cameras, etc. So they, many of them, are making decisions, calculating decisions that will help their career in the long run. And that, in my view, has affected why in many of these progressive left-wing cities, you have police departments that look feckless, essentially. And then with beat cops, another thing is a lot of them, with the low morale in just in all police departments across America because of demonization of police, a lot of them, they just couldn't really be bothered to put in that extra effort to actually enforce the law. Because if there's any use of force, even when it's justified, in all these riots and protests, all the press and all the rioters had their cameras trained in one direction on police. And these videos of police using force is then cut and taken out of context and blasted over and over to get these the specific officer pulled from his duties and placed under endless investigations that can ruin their law enforcement career as well. So from my sources...
But that's beat cops.
Correct. Yeah, I'm asking, like, why don't you guys seem to care more when you guys are responding? And he says, well,
Is my career really worth intervening?
And then on top of that, because they get named in the press, they get smeared, their families suffer. I mean, that's happened in Portland with police officers who have, in the course of their duties, then get targeted by Antifa, by the press and all that, and get placed under investigations. It's just all these variables coming together. Bad leadership from elected officials, bad leadership in police departments, a critical mass of the populace actually thinking what these extremists are doing is good, support in the mainstream media and local media. So this, you know, all of these conditions...
All these things help each other.
Yes, and there's still, these variables are still there even with now a new administration. It has, these riots are able to sustain and go on without Trump in the office. This whole claim that they're doing it to oppose the fascist regime of Trump was always a pretext and it's just an excuse for them to mainstream the extremism. And unfortunately, they were able to do that successfully with the aid of Democrats and journalists.
So that's also part of the problem there, that in the U.S. system, at least, your police force is somewhat politicized. So, yeah, I can really see some problems there. And it's not like, hearing that, I'm not unsympathetic to the police officers who are thinking about the political ramifications if they're in a slightly politicized office. Because one of the things you mentioned, which I couldn't wrap my head around the fact Mayor Ted Wheeler was reelected, and the fact that he was still in office and he hadn't been forced to resign throughout this whole escapade. And I think I got the answer in your book, which is that the people of Portland are not in a position to get rid of him, it seems. So you mentioned the fact that there was a lady running against him who was even more extreme than him. She was openly pro-Antifa. Like, she was given interviews where they asked very, very simple things, which is, if there is a building and there are people living above it, families, and Antifa set fire to the building, which will presumably then put the lives of the families in risk, likely killing them, do you condemn that? And she was asked this repeatedly in different ways, and she just couldn't really find herself getting to that point of saying, this is absolutely wrong, anyone engaging in this should be disavowed, and so forth.
She'd always pivot to what she said was violence by police, and she openly identified herself as Antifa, literally, I am Antifa, I'm proud of it, and she's worn clothing with the faces of totalitarian communist dictators from the 20th century, and she only lost to Ted Wheeler by...
I have the statistic here. She lost by 6 points to Ted Wheeler.
Yes, but there's a caveat to that. You can continue.
Yeah.
It gets worse.
The other candidate here, who was a write-in candidate... Sorry if people can hear a siren. the write-in candidate, who was also extreme, got 13 points. So if that write-in candidate haven't run, the people of Portland, you know, there are enough extreme people here who are willing to back this sort of thing. Yes. She would have become the mayor.
Yes,
the person who is openly in favor of, I'm just going to say it, people being murdered, because that's what I think her position is when she says, I'm, you know, unable to disavow the burning of buildings with people inside. That's what the public want to vote for, or at least show in their revealed preference that that's what they're happy to vote for. Mm-hmm. And if you're a cop, you know, so if you've got that sort of problem, if you're a cop who's then going to look at those statistics, why should you risk it? You know it's going to have a massive backlash. So I suppose what I'm getting at is, the way I'm seeing this, do the people of Portland and Seattle who do these, you know, who have to live with these problems, is it somewhat their fault by the fact that en masse they're voting for politicians who are unable to disavow this sort of thing or even enable it in this case?
They're part of the problem, but I wouldn't pin the problem on them. We need to also mention that the risk for speaking out and going against the grain is really severe. So,
do you mean a social risk for an individual? Or
everything. Safety, even. So in Seattle, there have been some businesses who signed a letter to the mayor, people who are in the capital area, the area where they suffered because of that siege, but in Chaz, and they wrote a letter calling for just a restoration of order. And these businesses, they were doxxed. So the Antifa put out the names of the owners behind each business and how they could be contacted. So
they were essentially listing, these are the traitors to the revolution.
Yes.
And the implication being, we ought to call
some. And people have come and smashed up the businesses repeatedly. So that's the risk of speaking out as well. So it's not a overwhelming, it's not a majority who's in support of these extremist acts. They may be Democrats or left wing. They don't support what's going on. But
I mean, when she loses only by 6 points.
That's right.
And this is a lady who's openly in favor of it.
That's, I mean, right.
I've got sympathy for people who are Democrats and just, this is part of a nonsense that's coming through the party. But when there's that much of the population, it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. Anyway. I also wanted to mention the part here, which is that how much do Democrats owe for this? Because, of course, there are extremists on the right wing who do terrible things in the United States and around the world. But we are specifically looking at Antifa here. And one of the interesting things I find as a foreigner looking at the United States is the Republicans, I'm not always in agreement with them. Obviously, I'm not an American Republican. But I do find it pretty interesting that the Capitol Hill riots, for example, immediate disavowal. I mean, Trump himself telling them to be peaceful beforehand. Afterwards, he'd make a video, tell them to go home, that sort of thing. I know there are all sorts of arguments about tidbits of how he should have done it, but the movement seemed to openly say, this is wrong, shouldn't be doing this. You know, Alex Jones was on the on the Capitol steps telling people not to do it. But when it comes to the Democratic types who are looking at people throwing IEDs, throwing Molotovs, they couldn't bring themselves to say no. And it's not just a local mayor in a place like Portland. You went to a meeting with Ted where I think Ted Cruz set it up, because Ted Cruz is a Republican. He wanted to make the point that Antifa are bad and should be disavowed. And there was a senator there called Senator Hirono who was representing the Democrats for that meeting and could not say that Antifa were bad or I disavow them, even after hearing your testimony and everyone else's testimony about this sort of thing. How much has this poisoned the Democratic Party? Do you think they can recover?
Well, the rule that they set up is that if you are critical of Antifa, that means you're pro-fascist. If you're critical of BLM, that means you're against Black Lives. So that type of rule has silenced so many people and caused so many people to be spuriously smeared as racist or fascist, whatever. I mean, those type of labels have been hurled on me. I think now, without Trump as an excuse and no longer as a shared mutual enemy with Antifa, you see that Antifa's goals has always been to destabilize the U.S. And they saw an opportunity, particularly because not just of the death of George Floyd and other people, but because of the economic strain caused by the policies related to COVID-19. But Democrats are desperately afraid of criticizing Antifa because of they don't want to be accused of being pro-fa. So You know, it's the irony here is just with the far left, with so many of them being non-binary, they're the most binary in their thinking, actually. You know, if you're not against, if you're against us, yeah, you're for fascism.
So there is a group in the UK, I believe in Scotland, they set up, it was like Anti-Capitalist Action or something like this, and it's been banned as a far-right group, because it doesn't matter what you call yourself, if your ideology is an extremist ideology, you will get on the prescription list if you're engaged in terrorism. I don't understand why that did not happen in the US. I don't care what they call themselves. You know, if, yeah, I set up a group called Anti-Capitalism and I engage in fascism, I'm going to be put on that terrorist list. I don't know why the reverse doesn't happen with the socialists.
Right. So, you know, I've been continuing to speak out in my criticisms of BLM, and BLM is seen as like a sacred cow in America.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, I don't care what these people who belong to these movements or groups call themselves. I look at what they say, what they do, and what they preach and what they call for. And all of it is pointing to violent extremist views and
open
insurrectionary,
terrorism.
Yes, terrorism. But to address the point of like, well, why doesn't the U.S. just prescribe or ban some of these groups? And that's where the First Amendment comes in. So, you know, it's the, by law, the U.S. government cannot ban any organization and cannot prosecute any individual for holding extremist views. That is protected by law. And
it is, I'm not going to say protected by law, but tradition that you aren't meant to do that in the UK as well. I was more getting at the fact that these, you know, very specific groups at least, have engaged in terrorist activity. So we mentioned Senator Hirono. She repeated this lie in this hearing from The Guardian that no one has died from anti-fascist violence. Just factually untrue. As you prove in this book, there are multiple instances of terrorist attacks, what could be called terrorist attacks, you know, even if you're being uncharitable and trying to defend Antifa. And people have died. A lot of the time, it does turn out to be the Antifa terrorist who dies because they're just bad at these attacks. But if an organization has extremist views, sure, that's up to them. But if an organization is engaging in terrorism, such as the ICE facility shooting and firebombing, is that not prescribable?
Well, it should be, but that's the thing. We all are, every police agency, every law enforcement agency in the US is heavily politicized. And so I think that's affected a lot of why they have, on some instances, arrested and charged far left militants who have engaged in federal crimes throughout 2020. But when it comes to actually really breaking up these networks that they're part of, they're not doing that.
Hmm.
I think it's fear, again, of being labeled as going against anti-fascists, right? Or going against anti-racists. And the thing about Antifa is they exploit the rights and protections that are given to them by the state while trying to undermine that. So they attack freedom of expression every turn through literal violence against other people. They actually will beat you if you have wrong think. But then when you go around and try to bring attention to not just the extremist ideology and rhetoric, but their extremist actions, then they say it's freedom of speech. They're just protesting. And so, you know, this whole the language is important because you'll see in the press repeatedly they have referred to the rioters as protesters and demonstrators, which is not an accurate description of the actions of these people. They did not call the Capitol Hill people who sieged the federal building on the 6th of January. They didn't call those people protesters, call them rioters. They don't apply the same standard to the people who are not just rioting in destroying property in the name of anti-fascism, but actually even killing, again, always given this benign name.
I
mean,
I would call that terrorist. I'm not even going to stick with rioter, but anyway. I wanted to get onto this point, which is something I alluded to earlier, which is the rethinking I had to have about these guys, realizing they're a bit smarter than I give them credit, which is more worrying to learn than anything, was the purpose of rioting, the purpose of smashing up Starbucks. So you mentioned about the you know, enormous amount of violence and what's the point in it. And you mentioned the broken windows theory. So this is a theory in which if there's one broken window, more broken windows are likely because people lose respect for the fact that the place looks nice. So a street that starts to get a bit grummy will get grummier really fast, if you know what I mean. And the idea is if you smash up the Starbucks, then people are going to be more likely to accept that other things will get smashed up, other buildings will be burned, other people will be, you know, threatened with their life. And this is known by these groups. So you mentioned here a Black Lives Matter co-founder talking to The New Yorker about what's going on. And they say, we don't have time for finger wagging at protesters about property. They can be rebuilt. Target can reopen. The stores will reopen. That's assured. But what's not assured is our safety or real justice. So the idea of the justice for the group is just more important than any personal property.
Correct.
Because the idea of personal property is just not important. And there's another quote here. They need to challenge the absurd notion that the social construct of purpose of property rights is more important than the needs of the people around us. Now, this sounds obvious, but I never put two and two together in my head in the way you laid it out that, no, they genuinely are up for breaking all the stuff and doing whatever God knows else on the basis that it undermines property rights, and therefore this is also alluding to the point that they're obviously socialists. Thanks for that, I guess. I never thought about it properly. What do you think that they... Do you think that they understand this is working? Because in my mind, it definitely seems to be working. I mean, we had some reports, I think it's about $1 trillion in damages for the last year's riots. And certainly the Democratic Party seems to be, you know, men are frag, I don't give a damn about the violence that's going on.
It is working. If you go to downtown Portland, for example, or some of these other areas where Antifa have repeatedly returned to riot, it's become a first world slum. Douglas Murray last autumn visited Portland, among other cities, and that was how he described it in a column he wrote in Spectator, and that is apt. You see, it's just businesses were already closed because of COVID, many of them permanently, and then they were looted in May, and the windows were repeatedly smashed over and over. And it wasn't like when businesses were boarded up, what the rioters would do is they would tear down the wooden boards and damage the buildings further, to the point where there's graffiti everywhere, there's rubbish everywhere on the streets. There are homeless encampments that get set up. And then the other thing that Antifa will defend are these homeless encampments. So they will actually go and patrol and call themselves protectors of these people. And they will actually attack and assault police who are trying to clear out these areas where tents are being set up in the streets or parks, whatever. They're really trying to... I mean, they're turning the whole city into like what Chad's looked like, and that's intentional because they want the breakdown in the public, in the trust in the rule of law and the state institutions itself. They want to put in the minds of people
that essentially the state can't protect you, and there's no point putting your faith in it.
Yeah, that the only people who can take care of you is us. You should come to our mutual aid tables. Mm. That's why, you know, things that look relatively benign, like the supplies of food and other so-called charity type stuff, it's meant to win over the hearts of people. It's similar to what jihadists and Islamists do when they take over or try to gain new members or sympathizers as well. So the thing is, there was so much money being poured into some of these Antifa groups that set up, literally, they're just ad hoc, the same people just setting up a number of groups in creating a Venmo and Cash App and having tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars pour in. And then once things didn't work out anymore, they would just close up shop and leave. And you have no idea what happened to some of this money. Some of them did that. But so like the distribution of the food and water.
It's all part of this broader plan.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that the structure is much closer to an Islamist group, mm-hmm. because that was exactly what I got out of this as well, going through the details. And I won't spoil everything, so there's you know, some things I'm not going to mention, but that's why you should buy the book. So you actually openly say it at one point when you're in Chaz, saying in many ways being at Chaz was like being among jihadists. The fact that these people were true believers and they were sort of forcing everyone into their worldview and the way they indoctrinated people. So there's also the obvious point of you see some of these more, I don't know, kind of absurd banners that you see them carrying. So liberation begins when America dies and death to America banners that they'll carry on their marches. I mean, that's one of the things I find most strange about this support from even moderate Democrats. You see them saying, oh, they're just anti-fascists. You know, obviously idiots. Like, these people are out to destroy the United States. They are not there just to be, you know, certain things. So I wonder, would you agree that these people essentially function in the same way as jihadists and should be somewhat treated in the same way as jihadists? Because if they're acting in the same way, they think in the same way, in the structures, obviously, not that they want to set up a caliphate.
The most extreme of them are similar to jihadists. I would say the majority of them are these sort of nonviolent Islamists. So the core group of Black Bloc Antifa, that is people who are donning the black uniform and mask and carrying weapons and carrying out attacks against property and people, that is a relatively small number of people. They're able to be so effective because of like larger concentric circles of supporters who share or sympathize with enough of the ideology that they act as, you know, they'll do these mutual aid support things like supply riot gear, supply food, supply transportation, get them bailed immediately out of jail, provide legal aid. And these activities that they're doing are not, it's not illegal, it's not prosecutable under the current law. And so there's a, we have to view it as an issue that goes way beyond just the street hooliganism. There's like a much larger system, and it includes people in that who are in so-called respectable white-collar professions, attorneys, professors, instructors, universities, attorneys, that's right, registered nurses. And so that creates a certain perception to the media and people who are ignorant about Antifa that, oh, these are, you know, it's just a group of, a large movement of people who are just against fascism. Because look, it includes all these regular people. And, you know, Antifa was centered that a lot. So during the riots in July last year, where people were trying literally to burn down the federal courthouse in downtown, they were using human shields of the Wall of Moms. These women who wore yellow shirts, many of them are recognized as the Antifa women. They just wore a yellow shirt. But some of them were regular Portlanders, mothers who came out and thinking they were opposing the fascist Trump administration.
The sort of moderates that are being duped.
Exactly. And they always had these people at the very front, literally at the front, so that when the federal officers were forced to use like tear gas or flashbangs, then the videos looked like they were targeting the innocent, you know, mothers and innocent protesters.
And then I saw the hearings. Democratic representatives were able to go to, I think it was a hearing with William Barr, and say, you know, they are not violent extremists. These are mothers. These are war veterans. These are moms who are being beaten and gassed by federal officers. Just an outright lie. But that's the value of the propaganda. And you can see in that how organized they are. The fact that they're making sure that the propaganda is all in the right place. They're only filming the cops. They will make the media only film the cops. They will wait until the media is gone to then come out and smash stuff. They'll use, you know, mums.
Well, they will attack journalists, live streamers who are trying to report their criminal activities. Yeah.
That's how they force them.
Yeah.
But your eccentric circle thing is actually perfect, because a lot of people will know Sam Harris used this to explain Islamism, which is that you have this hardcore center of the guys who will go out and carry out the attacks. And then around them, you've got these circles of support. So the fact that, you know, you have these people there who are willing to provide financial support and whatnot, and then media support, they're also part of the system, and they need to be taken into account of what they are, and need to be held account for what they are, in my opinion. But anyway, so one of the things I won't go too deep into, but I'm going to mention, because I didn't understand that this was real either, was the level of indoctrination that takes place in these organizations. So you make the point that a lot of people say, oh, it's not an organization. It's just groups of people. Well, you know, Al-Qaeda is groups of people by that standard. It's absolute nonsense. And that's why I think the jihadist comparison is best to make. And that if you join a jihadist group, they will slowly indoctrinate you into their ideology of a world caliphate and the Quran says so and so on and so forth. And I just never really thought for some reason that Antifa would be this sophisticated. And you mentioned the curriculums they set up for new members to make them higher and higher up the organization and the sort of standards you have to get. And this was got, I think you mentioned it was by a Project Veritas journalist who had gone undercover for a, I think it was a whole year he was with them.
In Rose City Antifa, the largest and oldest Antifa organization in the US, based in Portland.
Yeah. So if you could get a representative sample of what this is like, this is the best place to go.
Exactly.
And the things he had to do, or at least he was told to do by the organization, were not the sort of things a ragtag group of people would come up with. This has got to have been in place for a couple of years for you guys figuring out what you want. And I'm just going to mention the units, just so, and then people can read what's in the units for themselves. So they have Unit 2, for example, security, where they teach you about what you need to do. And then they have units on white supremacy and fascism to understand what we're looking at. And one of the weirdest things I got out of that is they seem to understand that their public message of Trump is a fascist, we are being oppressed by fascism, and USA is a fascist state, they know that's a lie. That was the strangest thing to read. Mm-hmm. They list in their, you know, what is this type of far-right ideology and this type, and a very detailed understanding. And then the understanding that right-wing politics isn't that. Right-wing politics is something else, and this is how they're different. Why do you think they do this?
It's to get liberal moderates on their side. They're not able to operate and do what they do without mainstream left support. So when you see that behind their violence is a very coherent ideology, you know, to get from, I've looked into the backgrounds of some of these people who have been arrested at the riots. That's why I've been doing chronicling all these public records of booking photos, charges, names. I look into who they are. And some of them still have social media profiles that are online. Most have deleted it. And if you go back just a year, more often than not, they will be a Bernie supporter and a member of the DSA, Democratic Socialist America. To get from that to the point of where they are willing to don the uniform of their comrades
and hurt journalists in the name
and
of
carry
the
weapons as well, there are many, many steps. So you're reading from the units right now, the units of the curriculum of Rose City Antifa. So in this book, I published primary documents from inside Rose City Antifa. So they've never been released before. And you'll see the indoctrination process. It's set up like a university curriculum. You have your readings, you have your group discussions, you have guest lecturers who include I name in the a Portland State University instructor. One of them is a journalist. So they're doing this behind closed doors while claiming to the public, we're not an organization. We're just grassroots. We're decentralized. And you can see it's not true. There's a vetting process for who becomes a member. And actually, even if you just complete the curriculum, that's not enough to become a member. So
no, as the Project Veritas guy found out after getting these primary documents, they then had a vote on him, and his unwillingness to use violence, you know, to go out and break the law, harm people, destroy property, that got him, I don't know if they have blackballing, but they did not advance him to the next stage.
Correct.
And that's when he ducked out, because these people are terrorists. Do not want to go too far. And it's just amazing that you could have required reading, you know, course competencies laid out like some university lecturer would do, who's been thinking about this for a long time. I mean, this must have been made up over a couple of years. You can see some of the new units at the bottom that are very, shall we say, modern, in the sense that they're covering intersectionality and very new fields, in which case this has been building up for ages. And the organization part, I think, absolutely is blown away by your explanation here. And the last thing I wanted to go on to was your personal part of this. So you mentioned in the book, you're trying to treat this as a journalistic integrity, which I think you do very well in all of your reporting, not to compliment you too much, but you're very good at just saying, like, this happened. And this happened, and this happened. You don't try and phrase it in the way a Republican right-winger would, who's trying to, you know, gin up political support. And it's the same with this book. Almost all of it, you try and remove yourself from the story. You even say at one point, I wanted to get myself out of it. But you unfortunately have to be part of it, because you're the eyewitness for a lot of these events. And for the crime of reporting on these people, what they honestly believe, what they honestly want to do, you've had them attack you at protests, as you've mentioned, but you've also had them come after you personally in your house. I didn't know anything about that. What has that done to you personally? Because I imagine if I started having, you know, neo-Nazis or something shot at my house, I would be losing my mind.
So they do everything that they accuse their opponents of doing. So they dox and they show up to people's homes. They encourage others, their comrades, to hurt and kill the targets. And so they have doxed me, and not just shown up to where I live, but they have put out information about my family. And so all of this, you know, in addition to the beating that they did, is just trying to create this atmosphere for me where I'm constantly terrorized. And all of these incidents, this is a very sad part, would be reported to police in Portland, and when applicable, reported to the FBI, and nothing would happen. Nobody's been arrested in the beating against me, and that was actually caught on video, and that was literally outside of the Central Police Station when it happened. So there's an impunity to their violence. They're able to get away with so much. And as much as I did not want to leave Portland, I didn't want to give them a victory in that, I was on borrowed time in 2020. While working on this book, it was terrifying because they were looking for me at these protests and riots, even though they knew I was undercover because they saw that I was getting out footage that's from somebody who had to be there. So they were eventually looking for anybody who had my body shape, my height, or looked vaguely East Asian through the eyes. And they actually, on several occasions, I think 5 or 6 of it, misidentified the wrong person based on race.
But they did correctly identify you at one point in Chaz.
They did. Yes. And this is how good their counter-intel is. It's not just the people who are there on the ground. They take video and photos, and they share it with their encrypted chat rooms that they are talking to all these other people who style themselves as like security experts. And they'll analyze this, this, and that. And some of them are very good at doing it. And so, unfortunately, none of these people have been held accountable for their criminal harassments and threats and violence. And but I keep going because it's not just me who's been victimized. There's been countless people, and almost none of them don't have the privilege of like a platform like I do, an audience like I do. So like I feel like I'm fighting for a lot of other people on their behalf as well. And
I mean, at least dozens of cities have had these people, if not directly, indirectly, had an effect on their lives. I can't think of any place where they've done more good than harm. So I imagine you do. But I saw, we're recording now, we've seen a lot of news reports saying that they recently found out you basically come to the UK. I don't know if you're on a tourist visa or something, but the reporting now is essentially that you're sort of fleeing Portland in a similar way. You lay out the history of your parents being Vietnamese, having to get out of the communist state of Vietnam. And the similarities with your life are obviously somewhat ironic, I suppose. Are you fleeing the United States now? Is the media reporting correct? Or are you just saying, I've had enough, folks. I can report on what's happened and that's me.
I write about my family in the afterword of the book just to tie this up and sort of to give a little bit of context of who I am. Who is Andy? Why is he writing all this? And my parents lived through a communist revolution in the 70s in Vietnam. They were from the former South Vietnam, which was allied with the United States in the war. And for different reasons, they were thrown into prison camps. My mother was very young. She was 16 years old, her whole family. And they were thrown into a prison camp because they owned business and property. That was their sin.
Rich peasants.
And then afterwards, just life was so oppressive for anybody who had gone through the prison camp system. They wanted to, in their words, socialize these traitors into good citizens. And that would include these periods of punishments, right? Like being barred from certain careers, not getting access to public aid in terms of food or whatever. There were food shortages and all that. So that was the reason for the really large diaspora of Vietnamese who left Vietnam in the late 70s, throughout the 80s. And the liberal Western societies opened up their arms and took them in, hundreds of thousands of them, more than 1 million around the world. My parents were eventually settled in America, and they received citizenship there. And so for me, like, I speak up against Antifa because I think America is worth defending, and its ideals are great and beautiful. It's not by accident that you have a society like the US or Britain or Canada or other Western liberal democracies. It comes from centuries of thought and trial and error and developing systems that have checks and balances. And these people who, in the name of racial justice, social justice, are trying to tear down everything. And, you know, they're claiming that they can make a new world, a new utopia. But again, I've been in the areas of where they have full control, and all they do for anybody is just misery and destruction and death. And so I hope for readers to pick up this book that they can understand how dangerous this movement ideology we're dealing with, and they're not going away just because we have a Democrat administration now. Not at all. If anything, they're ramping it up. And the Democrats who have kind of come around a bit, like Ted Wheeler now, who finally recently named Antifa in one of his Portland press conferences, well, he's been attacked by them. They've hunted him down at restaurants, assaulted him. They rioted outside his home. He's literally fled from his home. And so it's just with the breakdown of the rule of law in Portland and some other major American cities, and the threats against me that have led to no response from law enforcement, I didn't feel safe. I was not safe.
There was a serious terrorist threat against you, is how I describe it.
There's been several. So I've temporarily have had to flee home. I'm not sure quite where my next steps are yet, but unfortunately, Antifa has promised that they won't allow me to have a normal life. But I think that's a small price to pay for exposing the truth. So,
yeah, I mean, I'd say here, you were saying about the fact that people should read this to understand what they really think. I would definitely recommend this to anyone interested in politics, particularly if you're in any position to do anything. You know, any MP should be reading this to understand what this group is like, because in the UK, we may have had a less worse time of it because these people don't have access to firearms and so on and so forth. And we had a bit of a crackdown in 2001, which I'm quite, a story for another time, but the ideology will continue going on, and it's only getting more and more stronger. I mean, even with Biden in office, these people don't want Biden. They openly say they don't want Biden. They don't want any kind of moderation. They want the revolution.
That's right. One of the banners that they held in Portland on the Inauguration Day riot, where they destroyed the Democrat Party headquarters, was, say, "We don't want Biden. We want revenge." And then there was a graphic of a Kalashnikov rifle.
I suppose I should ask it. We asked it before the cameras went on, and I want people to know. So when did you come up with the idea of writing this? Because I had messages from people as the violence kicked off that maybe we ought to document this, so it's somewhere for people to know. So when did you start writing this?
It started planting the seeds by 2019, because by then in Portland, originally I was wanting to write about Portland and Antifa, because we had at that point around 3 years of recurring street brawls and just unrelenting recurring violence on the streets. And I started writing at the end of 2019, and the book was supposed to come out in 2020, actually. But then everything exploded across America in May, and you know, I had to ask for a large extension for the book, because I said, this is happening in real time. The whole book has to, like, kind of be restructured around what's happening right now. And I realized through the, at least in the beginning stages, that I had completely underestimated Antifa. I knew they were a dangerous movement, but I thought they were dangerous for places just like Portland and Seattle, not dangerous for the entire country. I never thought that they could actually claim city property as a sovereign city state and actually be able to hold that territory with weapons, which is what they did.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Chaz. I mean, a few others have been attempted to be set
In December, which, so this was after my manuscript was already submitted, so it's not in the book, but I mean, just a few months ago, a couple months ago in December in Portland, Antifa created another autonomous zone in Portland, mimicking what happened in Chaz. And they set up a hard border, and they set up actually booby traps on the streets. They had stockpile weapons of rocks and Molotov cocktails ready to go as soon as you, if you were an intruder in their territory. And they did it in a residential area where people and families live, and they had to flee for a week.
Anyway, I don't really know what to end it on otherwise than buy the bloody book. It's totally worth your time. Andy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, rechalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.